came to Mars with some assembly required. They were too big to send whole, so they're easy to dismantle. Over several trips, I moved all of their chunks to the trailer. I brought each chunk in through the airlock one at a time. It was a pain in the ass reassembling them inside, let me tell you. There's barely enough room for all the shit the trailer's got to hold. There wasn't much left for our intrepid hero. Then I got the AREC. It sat outside the hab like an AC unit might on Earth. In a way, that's what it is. I hauled it over to the trailer and lashed it to the shelf I'd made for it. Then I hooked it up to the feed lines that led through the balloon to the inside of the trailer's pressure vessel. The regulator needs to send air to the AREC, then the return air needs to bubble through the heat reservoir. The regulator also needs a pressure tank to contain the CO2 it pulls from the air. When gutting the trailer to make room, I left one tank in place for this. It's supposed to hold oxygen, but a tank's a tank. Thank God all the airlines and valves are standardized across the mission. That's no mistake. It was a deliberate decision to make field repairs easier. Once I had the AREC in place, I hooked the oxygenator and regulator into the trailer's power and watched them power up. I ran both through full diagnostics to confirm they were working correctly. Then I shut down the oxygenator. Remember, I'll only use it one soul out of every five. I moved to the rover, which meant I had to do an annoying 10-meter EVA. From there, I monitored the life support situation. It's worth noting that I can't monitor the actual support equipment from the rover. It's all in the trailer. But the rover can tell me all about the air. Oxygen, CO2, temperature, humidity, etc. Everything seemed okay. After getting back into the EVA suit, I released a canister of CO2 into the rover's air. I watched the rover computer have a shit fit when it saw the CO2 spike to lethal levels. Then, over time, the levels dropped to normal. The regulator was doing its job. Good boy. I left the equipment running when I returned to the hab. It'll be on its own all night, and I'll check it in the morning. It's not a true test, because I'm not there to breathe up the oxygen and make CO2, but one step at a time. Log entry. Sol 435. Last night was weird. I knew logically that nothing bad would happen in just one night, but it was a little unnerving to know I had no life support other than heaters. My life depended on some math I'd done earlier. If I dropped a sign or added two numbers wrong, I might never wake up. But I did wake up, and the main computer showed the slight rise in CO2 I had predicted. Looks like I'll live another soul. Live Another Soul would be an awesome name for a James Bond movie. I checked up on the rover. Everything was fine. If I don't drive it, a single charge of the batteries could keep the regulator going for over a month with the heater off. It's a pretty good safety margin to have. If all hell breaks loose on my trip, I'll have time to fix things. I'll be limited by oxygen consumption rather than CO2 removal, and I have plenty of oxygen. I decided it was a good time to test the bedroom. I got in the rover and attached the bedroom to the outer airlock door from the inside. Like I mentioned before, this is the only way to do it. Then I turned it loose on an unsuspecting Mars. As intended, the pressure from the rover blasted the canvas outward and inflated it. After that, chaos. The sudden pressure popped the bedroom like a balloon. It quickly deflated, leaving both itself and the rover devoid of air. I was wearing my EVA suit at the time. I'm not a fucking idiot. So I get to Live Another Soul, starring Mark Watney as, probably Q. I'm no James Bond. I dragged the popped bedroom into the hab and gave it a good going over. It failed at the seam where the wall met the ceiling. Makes sense. It's a right angle in a pressure vessel. Physics hates that sort of thing. First I patched it up, then I cut strips of spare canvas to place over the seam. Now it has double thickness and double sealing resin all around. Maybe that'll be enough. At this point, I'm kind of guessing. My amazing botany skills aren't much use for this. I'll test it again tomorrow. Log entry. Sol 436. I'm out of caffeine pills. No more Martian coffee for me. So it took a little longer for me to wake up this morning, and I quickly developed a splitting headache. One nice thing about living in a multi-billion-dollar mansion on Mars, access to pure oxygen. For some reason, a high concentration of O2 will kill most headaches. Don't know why, don't care. The important thing is I don't have to suffer. I tested out the bedroom again. I suited up in the rover and released the bedroom, same as last time, but this time it held. That's great, but having seen the fragile nature of my handiwork, I wanted a good long test of the pressure seal. After a few minutes standing around in my EVA suit, I decided to make better use of my time. I may not be able to leave the rover/bedroom universe while the bedroom is attached to the airlock, but I can stay in the rover and close the door. Once I did that, I took off the uncomfortable EVA suit. The bedroom was on the other side of the airlock door, still fully pressurized, so I'm still running my test, but I don't have to wear the EVA suit. I arbitrarily picked 8 hours for the test duration, so I was trapped in the rover until then. I spent my time planning the trip. There wasn't much to add to what I already knew. I'll beeline out of Acidalia Planitia to Morth Vallis, then follow the valley until it ends. It'll take me on a zigzag route which will dump me into Arabia Terra. After that, things get rough. Unlike Acidalia Planitia, Arabia Terra is riddled with craters, and each crater represents 2 brutal elevation changes, first down, then up. I did my best to find the shortest path around them. I'm sure I'll have to adjust the course when I'm actually driving it. No plan survives first contact with the enemy. Mitch took his seat in the conference room. The usual gang was present. Teddy, Venkat, Mitch, and Annie. But this time there was also Mindy Park, as well as a man Mitch had never seen before.
"What's up, Venk?" Mitch asked. "Why the sudden meeting?"
"We've got some developments," Venkat said. "Mindy, why don't you bring them up to date?"
"Yeah," Mindy said. "Looks like Watney finished the balloon addition to the trailer. It mostly uses the design we sent him."
"Any idea how stable it is?" Teddy asked.
"Pretty stable," she said. "It's been inflated for several days with no problems. Also, he built some kind of room."
"Room?" Teddy asked.
"It's made of hab canvas, I think," Mindy explained. "It attaches to the rover's airlock. I think he cut a section out of the hab to make it. I don't know what it's for."
Teddy turned to Venkat.
"Why would he do that?"
"We think it's a workshop," Venkat said. "There'll be a lot of work to do on the MAV once he gets to Schiaparelli. It'll be easier without an EVA suit. He probably plans to do as much as he can in that room."
"Clever," Teddy said. "Watney's a clever guy," Mitch said. "How about getting life support in there?"
"I think he's done it," Mindy said. "He moved the AREC. "Sorry," Annie interrupted. "What's an AREC? "It's the external component of the atmospheric regulator," Mindy said. "It sits outside the hab, so I saw when it disappeared. He probably mounted it on the rover. There's no other reason to move it, so I'm guessing he's got life support online."
"Awesome," Mitch said. "Things are coming together."
"Don't celebrate yet, Mitch," Venkat said.
He gestured to the newcomer.
"This is Randall Carter, one of our Martian meteorologists. Randall, tell them what you told me."
Randall nodded.
"Thank you, Dr. Kapoor."
He turned his laptop around to show a map of Mars.
"Over the past few weeks, a dust storm has been developing in Arabia Terra. Not a big deal in terms of magnitude. It won't hinder his driving at all."
"So what's the problem?" Annie asked.
"It's a low-velocity dust storm," Randall explained. "Slow winds, but fast enough to pick up very small particles on the surface and whip them into thick clouds. There are 5 or 6 of them every year. The thing is, they last for months, they cover huge sections of the planet, and they make the atmosphere thick with dust."
"I still don't see the problem," Annie said.
"Light," Randall said. "The total sunlight reaching the surface is very low in the area of the storm. Right now it's 20% of normal, and Watney's rover is powered by solar panels."
"Shit," Mitch said, rubbing his eyes. "And we can't warn him."
"So he gets less power," Annie said. "Can't he just recharge longer?"
"The current plan already has him recharging all day long," Venkat explained. "With 20% of normal daylight, it'll take 5 times as long to get the same energy. It'll turn his 45-soul trip into 225 souls. He'll miss the Hermes flyby.
Can't Hermes wait for him? Annie asked.
It's a flyby, Venkat said. Hermes isn't going into Martian orbit. If they did, they wouldn't be able to get back. They need their velocity for the return trajectory.
After a few moments of silence, Teddy said,
We'll just have to hope he finds a way through. We can track his progress and—
No, we can't, Mindy interrupted.
We can't, Teddy said.
She shook her head. The satellites won't be able to see through the dust. Once he enters the affected area, we won't see anything until he comes out the other side.
Well, Teddy said. Shit.
Log entry. Sol 439. Before I risk my life with this contraption, I need to test it. And not the little tests I've been doing so far. Sure, I've tested power generation, life support, the trailer bubble, and the bedroom. But I need to test all aspects of it working together. I'm going to load it up for the long trip and drive in circles. I won't ever be more than 500 meters from the hab, so I'll be fine if shit breaks. I dedicated today to loading up the rover and trailer for the test. I want the weight to match what it'll be on the real trip. Plus, if cargo is going to shift around or break things, I want to know about it now. I made one concession to common sense. I left most of my water supply in the hab. I loaded 20 liters, enough for the test, but no more. There are a lot of ways I could lose pressure in this mechanical abomination I've created, and I don't want all my water to boil off if that happens. On the real trip, I'm going to have 620 liters of water. I made up the weight difference by loading 600 kilograms of rocks in with my other supplies. Back on Earth, universities and governments are willing to pay millions to get their hands on Mars rocks. I'm using them as ballast. I'm doing one more little test tonight. I made sure the batteries were good and full, then disconnected the rover and trailer from hab power. I'll be sleeping in the hab, but I left the rover's life support on. It'll maintain the air overnight, and tomorrow I'll see how much power it ate up. I've watched the power consumption while it's attached to the hab, and there weren't any surprises. But this'll be the true proof. I call it the plugs-out test. Maybe that's not the best name.
The crew of Hermes gathered in the wreck. Let's get through status quickly, Lewis said. We're all behind in our science assignments. Vogel, you first.
I repaired Sabad cable on Vasima 4, Vogel reported. It was our last thick-gauge cable. If another such problem occurs, we will have to braid lower-gauge lines to carry the current. Also, the power output from the reactor is declining.
Johansson, Lewis said, what's the deal with the reactor?
I had to dial it back, Johansson said. It's the cooling vanes. They aren't radiating heat as well as they used to. They're tarnishing.
How can that happen? Lewis asked. They're outside the craft. There's nothing for them to react with.
I think they picked up dust or small air leaks from Hermes itself. One way or another, they're definitely tarnishing. The tarnish is clogging the microlattice, and that reduces the surface area. Less surface area means less heat dissipation. So I limited the reactor enough that we weren't getting positive heat.
Any chance of repairing the cooling vanes?
It's on the microscopic scale, Johansson said. We'd need a lab. Usually they replace the vanes after each mission.
Will we be able to maintain engine power for the rest of the mission?
Yes, if the rate of tarnishing doesn't increase.
All right, keep an eye on it. Beck, how's life support?
Limping, Beck said. We've been in space way longer than it was designed to handle. There are a bunch of filters that would normally be replaced each mission. I found a way to clean them with a chemical bath I made in the lab, but it eats away at the filters themselves. We're okay right now, but who knows what'll break next.
We knew this would happen, Lewis said. The design of Hermes assumed it would get an overhaul after each mission, but we've extended Ares III from 396 days to 898. Things are going to break. We've got all of NASA to help when that happens. We just need to stay on top of maintenance.
Martinez, what's the deal with your bunk room?
Martinez furrowed his brow.
He's still trying to cook me. The climate control just isn't keeping up. I think it's the tubing in the walls that brings the coolant. I can't get at it because it's built into the hull. We can use the room for storage of non-temperature-sensitive cargo, but
That's about it.
So did you move into Mark's room?
It's right next to mine, he said. It has the same problem.
Where have you been sleeping?
An airlock, too. It's the only place I can be without people tripping over me.
No good, Lewis said, shaking her head. If one seal breaks, you die.
I can't think of anywhere else to sleep, he said. The ship is pretty cramped, and if I sleep in a hallway, I'll be in people's way.
Okay, from now on, sleep in Beck's room. Beck can sleep with Johansson.
Johansson blushed and looked down awkwardly.
So, Beck said, you know about that?
You thought I didn't? Lewis said. It's a small ship.
You're not mad?
If it were a normal mission, I would be, Lewis said. But we're way off script now. Just keep it from interfering with your duties, and I'm happy.
Million Mile High Club, Martinez said. Nice.
Johansson blushed deeper and buried her face in her hands. Log entry. Sol 444.
I'm getting pretty good at this. Maybe when all this is over, I could be a product tester for Mars Rovers. Things went well. I spent 5 sols driving in circles. I averaged 93 kilometers per sol. That's a little better than I'd expected. The terrain here is flat and smooth, so it's pretty much a best-case scenario. Once I'm going up hills and around boulders, it won't be nearly that good. The bedroom is awesome. Large, spacious, and comfortable. On the first night, I ran into a little problem with the temperature. It was fucking cold. The rover and trailer regulate their own temperatures just fine, but things weren't hot enough in the bedroom. Story of my life. The rover has an electric heater that pushes air with a small fan. I don't use the heater itself for anything because the RTG provides all the heat I need, so I liberated the fan and wired it into a power line near the airlock. Once it had power, all I had to do was point it at the bedroom. It's a low-tech solution, but it worked. There's plenty of heat thanks to the RTG. I just needed to get it evenly spread out. For once, entropy was on my side. I've discovered that raw potatoes are disgusting. When I'm in the hab, I cook my taters using a small microwave. I don't have anything like that in the rover. I could easily bring the hab's microwave into the rover and wire it in, but the energy required to cook 10 potatoes a day would actually cut into my driving distance. I fell into a routine pretty quickly. In fact, it was hauntingly familiar. I did it for 22 miserable sols on the Pathfinder trip, but this time I had the bedroom, and that makes all the difference. Instead of being cooped up in the rover, I have my own little hab. After waking up, I have a potato for breakfast. Then I deflate the bedroom from the inside. It's kind of tricky, but I worked out how. First, I put on an EVA suit. Then I close the inner airlock door, leaving the outer door, which the bedroom is attached to, open. This isolates the bedroom with me in it from the rest of the rover. Then I tell the airlock to depressurize. It thinks it's just pumping the air out of a small area, but it's actually deflating the whole bedroom. Once the pressure is gone, I pull the canvas in and fold it. Then I detach it from the outer hatch and close the outer door. This is the most cramped part. I have to share the airlock with the entire folded-up bedroom while it repressurizes. Once I have pressure again, I open the inner door and more or less fall into the rover. Then I stow the bedroom and go back to the airlock for a normal egress to Mars. It's a complicated process, but it detaches the bedroom without having to depressurize the rover cabin. Remember, the rover has all my stuff that doesn't play well with vacuum. The next step is to gather up the solar cells I laid out the day before and stow them on the rover and trailer. Then I do a quick check on the trailer. I go in through its airlock and basically take a quick look at all the equipment. I don't even take off my EVA suit. I just want to make sure nothing's obviously wrong. Then, back to the rover. Once inside, I take off the EVA suit and start driving. I drive for almost 4 hours, and then I'm out of power. Once I park, it's back into the EVA suit for me and out to Mars again. I lay the solar panels out and get the batteries charging. Then I set up the bedroom, pretty much the reverse of the sequence I used to stow it. Ultimately, it's the airlock that inflates it. In a way, the bedroom is just an extension of the airlock. Even though it's possible, I don't rapid inflate the bedroom.
I did that to test it because I wanted to find where it'll leak, but it's not a good idea. Rapid inflation puts a lot of shock and pressure on it. It would eventually rupture. I didn't enjoy that time the HAB launched me like a cannonball. I'm not eager to repeat it. Once the bedroom is set up again, I can take off my EVA suit and relax. I mostly watch crappy 70s TV. I'm indistinguishable from an unemployed guy for most of the day. I followed that process for four sols, and then it was time for an air day. An air day turns out to be pretty much the same as any other day, but without the four-hour drive. Once I set up the solar panels, I fired up the oxygenator and let it work through the backlog of CO2 that the regulator has stored up. It converted all the CO2 to oxygen and used up the day's power generation to do it. The test was a success. I'll be ready on time. Log entry. Sol 449. Today's the big day. I'm leaving for Schiaparelli. The rover and trailer are all packed. They've been mostly packed since the test run, but now I even have the water aboard. Over the last few days, I cooked all the potatoes with the HAB's microwave. It took quite a while because the microwave can only hold four at a time. After cooking, I put them back out on the surface to freeze. Once frozen, I put them back in the rover's saddlebags. This may seem like a waste of time, but it's critical. Instead of eating raw potatoes during my trip, I'll be eating cold, pre-cooked potatoes. First off, they'll taste a lot better, but more important, they'll be cooked. When you cook food, the proteins break down and the food becomes easier to digest. I'll get more calories out of it, and I need every calorie I can get my hands on. I spent the last several days running full diagnostics on everything. The regulator, oxygenator, RTG, AREC, batteries, rover life support, in case I need a backup, solar cells, rover computer, airlocks, and everything else with a moving part or electronic component. I even checked each of the motors. 8 in all, 1 for each wheel, 4 on the rover, 4 on the trailer. The trailer's motors won't be powered, but it's nice to have backups. It's all good to go. No problems that I can see. The HAB is a shell of its former self. I've robbed it of all critical components and a big chunk of its canvas. I've looted that poor HAB for everything it could give me, and in return it's kept me alive for a year and a half. It's like the Giving Tree. I performed the final shutdown today. The heaters, lighting, main computer, etc. All the components I didn't steal for the trip to Schiaparelli. I could have left them on. It's not like anyone would care. But the original procedure for Sol 31, which was supposed to be the last day of the surface mission, was to completely shut down the HAB and deflate it, because NASA didn't want a big tent full of combustible oxygen next to the MAV when it launched. I guess I did the shutdown as an homage to the mission Ares 3 could have been. A small piece of the Sol 31 I never got to have. Once I'd shut everything down, the interior of the HAB was eerily silent. I'd spent 449 sols listening to its heaters, vents, and fans. But now it was dead quiet. It was a creepy kind of quiet that's hard to describe. I've been away from the noises of the HAB before, but always in a rover or an EVA suit, both of which have noisy machinery of their own. But now there was nothing. I never realized how utterly silent Mars is. It's a desert world with practically no atmosphere to convey sound. I could hear my own heartbeat. Anyway, enough waxing philosophical. I'm in the rover right now. That should be obvious with the HAB main computer offline forever. I've got 2 full batteries, all systems are go, and I've got 45 sols of driving ahead of me. Schiaparelli or bust. Chapter 22. Log entry. Sol 458. Marth Vallis. I'm finally here. Actually, it's not an impressive accomplishment. I've only been traveling 10 sols, but it's a good psychological milestone. So far, the rover and my ghetto life support are working admirably, at least as well as can be expected for equipment being used 10 times longer than intended. Today is my second air day, The first was 5 sols ago. When I put this scheme together, I figured air days would be god-awful boring. But now I look forward to them. They're my days off. On a normal day, I get up, fold up the bedroom, stack the solar cells, drive 4 hours, set up the solar cells, unfurl the bedroom, check all my equipment, especially the rover chassis and wheels, then make a Morse code status report for NASA, if I can find enough nearby rocks. On an air day, I wake up and turn on the oxygenator. The solar panels are already out from the day before. Everything's ready to go. Then I chill out in the bedroom or rover. I have the whole day to myself. The bedroom gives me enough space that I don't feel cooped up, and the computer has plenty of shitty TV reruns for me to enjoy. Technically, I entered Marth Vallis yesterday, but I only knew that by looking at a map. The entrance to the valley is wide enough that I couldn't see the canyon walls in either direction, but now I'm definitely in a canyon, and the bottom is nice and flat, exactly what I was hoping for. It's amazing. This valley wasn't made by a river slowly carving it away. It was made by a mega flood in a single day. It would have been a hell of a thing to see. Weird thought. I'm not in Acidalia Planitia anymore. I spent 457 sols there, almost a year and a half, and I'll never go back. I wonder if I'll be nostalgic about that later in life. If there is a later in life, I'll be happy to endure a little nostalgia. But for now, I just want to go home.
Welcome back to CNN's Mark Watney Report, Kathy said to the camera. We're speaking with our frequent guest, Dr. Venkat Kapoor. Dr. Kapoor, I guess what people want to know is Mark Watney doomed?
We hope not, Venkat responded, but he's got a real challenge ahead of him.
According to your latest satellite data, the dust storm in Arabia Terra isn't abating at all and will block 80% of the sunlight.
That's correct.
And Watney's only source of energy is his solar panels, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Can his makeshift rover operate at 20% power?
We haven't found any way to make that happen, no. His life support alone takes more energy than that.
How long until he enters the storm?
He's just entered Marth Vallis now. At his current rate of travel, he'll be at the edge of the storm on Sol 471. That's 12 days from now.
Surely he'll see something is wrong, Kathy said. With such low visibility, it won't take long for him to realize his solar cells will have a problem. Couldn't he just turn around at that point?
Unfortunately, everything's working against him, Venkat said. The edge of the storm isn't a magic line. It's just an area where the dust gets a little more dense. It'll keep getting more and more dense as he travels onward. It'll be really subtle. Every day will be slightly darker than the last, too subtle to notice.
Venkat sighed. He'll go hundreds of kilometers wondering why his solar panel efficiency is going down before he notices any visibility problems. And the storm is moving west as he moves east. He'll be too deep in to get out.
Are we just watching a tragedy play out? Kathy asked.
There's always hope, Venkat said. Maybe he'll figure it out faster than we think and turn around in time. Maybe the storm will dissipate unexpectedly. Maybe he'll find a way to keep his life support going on less energy than we thought was possible. Mark Watney is now an expert at surviving on Mars. If anyone can do it, it's him.
12 days, Kathy said to the camera. All of Earth is watching, but powerless to help.
Log entry. Sol 462. Another uneventful sol. Tomorrow is an air day, so this is kind of my Friday night. I'm about halfway through Marth Vallis now. Just as I'd hoped, the going has been easy. No major elevation changes. Hardly any obstacles, just smooth sand with rocks smaller than half a meter. You may be wondering how I navigate. When I went to Pathfinder, I watched Phobos transit the sky to figure out the east-west axis, but Pathfinder was an easy trip compared to this, and I had plenty of landmarks to navigate by. I can't get away with that this time. My map, such as it is, consists of satellite images far too low resolution to be of any use. I can only see major landmarks, like craters 50 kilometers across. They just never expected me to be out this far. The only reason I had high-res images of the Pathfinder region is because they were included for landing purposes, in case Martinez had to land way long of our target. So this time around, I needed a reliable way to fix my position on Mars. Latitude and longitude. That's the key. The first is easy. Ancient sailors on Earth figured that one out right away. Earth's 23.5-degree axis points at Polaris. Mars has a tilt of just over 25 degrees, so it's pointed at Deneb. Making a sextant isn't hard. All you need is a tube to look through, a string, a weight, and something with degree markings. I made mine in under an hour. So I go out every night with a homemade sextant and sight Deneb. It's kind of silly if you think about it. I'm in my spacesuit on Mars and I'm navigating with 16th century tools, but hey, they work. Longitude is a different matter. On Earth, the earliest way to work out longitude required them to know the exact time, then compare it to the sun's position in the sky. The hard part for them back then was inventing a clock that would work on a boat. Pendulums don't work on boats. All the top scientific minds of the age worked on the problem. Fortunately, I have accurate clocks. There are four computers in my immediate line of sight right now, and I have Phobos. Because Phobos is ridiculously close to Mars, it orbits the planet in less than one Martian day. It travels west to east, unlike the Sun and Deimos, and sets every 11 hours, and naturally, it moves in a very predictable pattern. I spend 13 hours every sol just sitting around while the solar panels charge the batteries. Phobos is guaranteed to set at least once during that time. I note the time when it does, then I plug it into a nasty formula I worked out, and I know my longitude. So working out longitude requires Phobos to set, and working out latitude requires it to be night so I can sight Deneb. It's not a very fast system, but I only need it once a day. I work out my location when I'm parked and account for it in the next day's travel. It's kind of a successive approximation thing. So far, I think it's been working, but who knows? I can see it now, me holding a map, scratching my head, trying to figure out how I ended up on Venus. Mindy Park zoomed in on the latest satellite photo with practiced ease. Watney's encampment was visible in the center, the solar cells laid out in a circular pattern as was his habit. The workshop was inflated. Checking the timestamp on the image, she saw it was from noon local time. She quickly found the status report. Watney always placed it close to the rover when rocks were in abundance, usually to the north. To save time, Mindy had taught herself Morse code so she wouldn't have to look each letter up every morning. She opened an email and addressed it to the ever-growing list of people who wanted Watney's daily status message. On track for Sol 494 arrival. She frowned and added, Note, 5 sols until dust storm entry. Log entry. Sol 466. Marth Vallis was fun while it lasted. I'm in Arabia Terra now. I just entered the edge of it, if my latitude and longitude calculations are correct, but even without the math, it's pretty obvious the terrain is changing. For the last two sols, I've spent almost all my time on an incline, working my way up the back wall of Marth Vallis. It was a gentle rise, but a constant one. I'm at a much higher altitude now. Acidalia Planitia, where the lonely Hab is hanging out, is 3,000 meters below elevation zero, and Arabia Terra is 500 meters below, so I've gone up 2.5 kilometers. Want to know what elevation zero means? On Earth, it's sea level. Obviously, that won't work on Mars, so lab-coated geeks got together and decided Mars's elevation zero is where the air pressure is 610.5 pascals. That's about 500 meters up from where I am right now. Now things get tricky. Back in Acidalia Planitia, if I got off course, I could just point in the right direction based on new data. Later, in Marth Vallis, it was impossible to screw up. I just had to follow the canyon. Now I'm in a rougher neighborhood, the kind of neighborhood where you keep your rover doors locked and never come to a complete stop at intersections. Well, not really, but it's bad to get off course here. Arabia Terra has large, brutal craters that I have to drive around. If I navigate poorly, I'll end up at the edge of one. I can't just drive down one side and up the other. Rising in elevation costs a ton of energy. On flat ground, I can make 90 kilometers per day. On a steep slope, I'd be lucky to get 40 kilometers. Plus, driving on a slope is dangerous. One mistake and I could roll the rover. I don't even want to think about that. Yes, I'll eventually have to drive down into Schiaparelli. No way around that. I'll have to be really careful. Anyway, if I end up at the edge of a crater, I'll have to backtrack to somewhere useful, and it's a damn maze of craters out here. I'll have to be on my guard, observant at all times. I'll need to navigate with landmarks as well as latitude and longitude. My first challenge is to pass between the craters Rutherford and Truvolo. It shouldn't be too hard. They're 100 kilometers apart. Even I can't fuck that up, right? Right? Log entry. Sol 468. I managed to thread the needle between Rutherford and Truvolo nicely. Admittedly, the needle was 100 kilometers wide, but hey. I'm now enjoying my fourth air day of the trip. I've been on the road for 20 sols. So far, I'm right on schedule. According to my maps, I've traveled 1,440 kilometers. Not quite halfway there, but almost. I've been gathering soil and rock samples from each place I camp. I did the same thing on my way to Pathfinder, but this time I know NASA's watching me, so I'm labeling each sample by the current sol. They'll know my location a hell of a lot more accurately than I do. They can correlate the samples with their locations later. It might be a wasted effort. The MAV isn't going to have much weight allowance when I launch. To intercept Hermes, it'll have to reach escape velocity, but it was only designed to get to orbit. The only way to get it going fast enough is to lose a lot of weight. At least that jury-rigging will be NASA's job to work out, not mine. Once I get to the MAV, I'll be back in contact with them, and they can tell me what modifications to make. They'll probably say thanks for gathering samples, but leave them behind. And one of your arms, too, whichever one you like least. But on the off chance I can bring the samples, I'm gathering them. The next few days' travel should be easy. The next major obstacle is Marth Crater. It's right in my straight-line path toward Schiaparelli. It'll cost me 100 kilometers or so to go around, but it can't be helped. I'll try to aim for the southern edge. The closer I get to the rim, the less time I'll waste going around it. "Did you read today's updates?" Lewis asked, pulling her meal from the microwave. "Yeah," Martinez said, sipping his drink. She sat across the rec table from him and carefully opened the steaming package. She decided to let it cool a bit before eating. "Mark entered the dust storm yesterday." "Yeah, I saw that," he said. "We need to face the possibility that he won't make it to Schiaparelli," Lewis said. "If that happens, we need to keep morale up. We still have a long way to go before we get home." "He was dead before," Martinez said. "It was rough on morale, but we soldiered on. Besides, he won't die." "It's pretty bleak, Rick," Lewis said. "He's already 50 kilometers into the storm, and he'll go another 90 kilometers per sol. He'll get in too deep to recover soon." Martinez shook his head. "He'll pull through, Commander. Have faith." She smiled forlornly. "Rick, you know I'm not religious." "I know," he said. "I'm not talking about faith in God. I'm talking about faith in Mark Watney. Look at all the shit Mars has thrown at him, and he's still alive. He'll survive this. I don't know how, but he will. He's a clever son of a bitch." Lewis took a bite of her food. "I hope you're right." "Want to bet $100? Martinez said with a smile. "Of course not," Lewis said. "Damn right," he smiled. "I'd never bet on a crewmate dying," Lewis said. "But that doesn't mean I think he'll..." "Blah, blah, blah," Martinez interrupted. "Deep down, you think he'll make it." Log entry. Sol 473. My fifth air day, and things are going well. I should be skimming south of Marth Crater tomorrow. It'll get easier after that. I'm in the middle of a bunch of craters that form a triangle. I'm calling it the Watney Triangle, because after what I've been through, stuff on Mars should be named after me. Truvolo, Becquerel, and Marth form the points of the triangle,
with five other major craters along the sides. Normally this wouldn't be a problem at all, but with my extremely rough navigation I could easily end up at the lip of one of them and have to backtrack. After Marth, I'll be out of the Watney Triangle. Yeah, I'm liking that name more and more. Then I can beeline towards Schiaparelli with impunity. There'll still be plenty of craters in the way, but they're comparatively small, and going around them won't cost much time. Progress has been great. Arabia Terra is certainly rockier than Acidalia Planitia, but nowhere near as bad as I'd feared. I've been able to drive over most of the rocks and around the ones that are too big. I have 1,435 kilometers left to go. I did some research on Schiaparelli and found some good news. The best way in is right in my direct line path. I won't have to drive the perimeter at all. And the way in is easy to find even when you suck at navigating. The northwest rim has a small crater on it, and that's the landmark I'll be looking for. To the southwest of that little crater is a gentle slope into Schiaparelli Basin. The little crater doesn't have a name, at least not on the maps I have, so I dub it Entrance Crater, because I can. In other news, my equipment is starting to show signs of age. Not surprising, considering it's way the hell past its expiration date. For the past two sols, the batteries have taken longer to recharge. The solar cells just aren't producing as much wattage as before. It's not a big deal. I just need to charge a little longer. Log entry. Sol 474. Well, I fucked it up. It was bound to happen eventually. I navigated badly and ended up at the ridge of Marth Crater. Because it's 100 kilometers wide, I can't see the whole thing, so I don't know where on the circle I am. The ridge runs perpendicular to the direction I was going, so I have no clue which way I should go, and I don't want to take the long way around if I can avoid it. Originally, I wanted to go around to the south, but north is just as likely to be the best path now that I'm off course. I'll have to wait for another Phobos transit to get my longitude, and I'll need to wait for nightfall to sight Deneb for my latitude, so I'm done driving for the day. Luckily, I'd made 70 kilometers out of the 90 kilometers I usually do, so it's not too much wasted progress. Marth isn't too steep. I could probably just drive down one side and up the other. It's big enough that I'd end up camping inside it one night, but I don't want to take unnecessary risks. Slopes are bad and should be avoided. I gave myself plenty of buffer time, so I'm going to play it safe. I'm ending today's drive early and setting up for recharge. Probably a good idea anyway with the solar cells acting up. It'll give them more time to work. They underperformed again last night. I checked all the connections and made sure there wasn't any dust on them, but they still just aren't 100%. Log entry. Sol 475. I'm in trouble. I watched two Phobos transits yesterday and sighted Deneb last night. I worked out my location as accurately as I could, and it wasn't what I wanted to see. As far as I can tell, I hit Marth Crater dead on. Crap. I can go north or south. One of them will probably be better than the other, because it'll be a shorter path around the crater. I figured I should put at least a little effort into figuring out which direction was best, so I took a little walk this morning. It was over a kilometer to the peak of the rim. That's the sort of walk people do on Earth without thinking twice, but in an EVA suit, it's an ordeal. I can't wait till I have grandchildren. When I was younger, I had to walk to the rim of a crater. Uphill! In an EVA suit! On Mars, you little shit! You hear me? Mars! Anyway, I got up to the rim. And damn, it's a beautiful sight. From my high vantage point, I got a stunning panorama. I figured I might be able to see the far side of Marth Crater and maybe work out the best way around, but I couldn't see the far side. There was a haze in the air. It's not uncommon. Mars has weather and wind and dust, after all. But it seemed hazier than it should. I'm accustomed to the wide-open expanses of Acidalia Planitia, my former prairie home. Then it got weirder. I turned around and looked back toward the rover and trailer. Everything was where I'd left it. Very few car thieves on Mars. But the view seemed a lot clearer. I looked east, across Marth again, then west to the horizon, then east, then west.
Each turn required me to rotate my whole body, EVA suits being what they are. Yesterday I passed a crater. It's about 50 kilometers west of here. It's just visible on the horizon. But looking east, I can't see anywhere near that far. Marth Crater is 110 kilometers wide. With a visibility of 50 kilometers, I should at least be able to see a distinct curvature of the rim. But I can't. At first I didn't know what to make of it, but the lack of symmetry bothered me, and I've learned to be suspicious of everything. That's when a bunch of stuff started to dawn on me. 1. The only explanation for asymmetrical visibility is a dust storm. 2. Dust storms reduce the effectiveness of solar cells. 3. My solar cells have been slowly losing effectiveness for several sols. From this, I concluded the following. 1. I've been in a dust storm for several sols. 2. Shit. Not only am I in a dust storm, but it gets thicker as I approach Schiaparelli. A few hours ago I was worried because I had to go around Marth Crater. Now I'm going to have to go around something a lot bigger. And I have to hustle. Dust storms move. Sitting still means I'll likely get overwhelmed. But which way do I go? It's no longer an issue of trying to be efficient. If I go the wrong way this time, I'll eat dust and die. I don't have satellite imagery. I have no way of knowing the size or shape of the storm or its heading. Man, I'd give anything for a 5-minute conversation with NASA. Now that I think of it, NASA must be shitting bricks watching this play out. I'm on the clock. I have to figure out how to figure out what I need to know about the storm, and I have to do it now. And right this second, nothing comes to mind. Mindy trudged to her computer. Today's shift began at 2:10 p.m. Her schedule matched Watney's every day. She slept when he slept. Watney simply slept at night on Mars, while Mindy had to drift 40 minutes forward every day, taping aluminum foil to her windows to get any sleep at all. She brought up the most recent satellite images. She cocked an eyebrow. He had not broken camp yet. Usually he drove in the early morning, as soon as it was light enough to navigate. Then he capitalized on the midday sun to maximize recharging. But today he had not moved, and it was well past morning. She checked around the rovers and the bedroom for a message. She found it in the usual place, north of the campsite. As she read the Morse code, her eyes widened. Dust storm. Making plan. Fumbling with her cell phone, she dialed Venkat's personal number. Chapter 23. Log Entry. Sol 476. I think I can work this out. I'm on the very edge of a storm. I don't know its size or heading, but it's moving, and that's something I can take advantage of. I don't have to wander around exploring it. It'll come to me. The storm is just dust in the air. It's not dangerous to the rovers. I can think of it as percent power loss. I checked yesterday's power generation and it was 97% of optimal, so right now, it's a 3% storm. I need to make progress and I need to regenerate oxygen. Those are my two main goals. I use 20% of my overall power to reclaim oxygen when I stop for air days. If I end up in an 81% part of the storm, I'll be in real trouble. I'll run out of oxygen even if I dedicate all available power to producing it. That's the fatal scenario. But really, it's fatal much earlier than that. I need power to move, or I'll be stranded until the storm passes or dissipates. That could be months. The more power I generate, the more I'll have for movement. With clear skies, I dedicate 80% of my total power toward movement. I get 90 kilometers per sol this way. So right now, at 3% loss, I'm getting 2.7 kilometers less than I should. It's okay to lose some driving distance per sol. I have plenty of time, but I can't let myself get too deep in the storm or I'll never be able to get out. At the very least, I need to travel faster than the storm. If I can go faster, I can maneuver around it without being enveloped, so I need to find out how fast it's moving. I can do that by sitting here for a sol. I can compare tomorrow's wattage to today's. All I have to do is make sure to compare at the same times of day.
Then I'll know how fast the storm is moving, at least in terms of percent power loss. But I need to know the shape of the storm, too. Dust storms are big. They can be thousands of kilometers across. So when I work my way around it, I'll need to know which way to go. I'll want to move perpendicular to the storm's movement and in whatever direction has less storm. So here's my plan. Right now, I can go 86 kilometers because I couldn't get a full battery yesterday. Tomorrow, I'm going to leave a solar cell here and drive 40 kilometers due south. Then I'll drop off another solar cell and drive another 40 kilometers due south. That'll give me 3 points of reference across 80 kilometers. The next day, I'll go back to collect the cells and get the data. By comparing the wattage at the same time of day in those three locations, I'll learn the shape of the storm. If the storm is thicker to the south, I'll go north to get around it. If it's thicker north, I'll go south. I'm hoping to go south. Schiaparelli is southeast of me. Going north would add a lot of time to my total trip. There's one slight problem with my plan. I don't have any way to record the wattage from an abandoned solar cell. I can easily track and log wattage with the rover computer, but I need something I can drop off and leave behind. I can't just take readings as I drive along. I need readings at the same time in different places. So I'm going to spend today working on some mad science. I have to make something that can log wattage, something I can leave behind with a single solar cell. Since I'm stuck here for the day anyway, I'll leave the solar cells out. I may as well get a full battery out of it. Log entry. Sol 477. It took all day yesterday and today, but I think I'm ready to measure this storm. I needed a way to log the time of day and the wattage of each solar cell. One of the cells would be with me, but the other two would be dropped off and left far away. And the solution was the extra EVA suit I brought along. EVA suits have cameras recording everything they see. There's one on the right arm, or the left if the astronaut is left-handed, and another above the faceplate. A timestamp is burned into the lower left corner of the image, just like on the shaky home videos Dad used to take. My electronics kit has several power meters, so I figured, why make my own logging system? I can just film the power meter all day long. So that's what I set up. When I packed for this road trip, I made sure to bring all my kits and tools, just in case I had to repair the rover en route. First, I harvested the cameras from my spare EVA suit. I had to be careful. I didn't want to ruin the suit. It's my only spare. I extracted the cameras and the lines leading to their memory chips. I put a power meter into a small sample container, then glued a camera to the underside of the lid. When I sealed up the container, the camera was properly recording the readout of the power meter. For testing, I used rover power. How will my logger get power once I abandon it on the surface? It'll be attached to a 2-square-meter solar cell. That'll provide plenty of power. And I put a small rechargeable battery in the container to tide it over during nighttime. Again, harvested from the spare EVA suit. The next problem was heat, or the lack thereof. As soon as I take this thing out of the rover, it'll start cooling down mighty fast. If it gets too cold, the electronics will stop working. So I needed a heat source, and my electronics kit provided the answer. Resistors. Lots and lots of them. Resistors heat up. It's what they do. The camera and the power meter only need a tiny fraction of what a solar cell can make, so the rest of the energy goes through resistors. I made and tested 2 power loggers and confirmed that the images were being properly recorded. Then I had an EVA. I detached 2 of my solar cells and hooked them up to the power loggers. I let them log happily for an hour, then brought them back in to check the results. They worked great. It's getting toward nightfall now. Tomorrow morning I'll leave 1 power logger behind and head south. While I was working, I left the oxygenator going. Why not? So I'm all stocked up on O2 and good to go. The solar cell efficiency for today was 92.5%, compared to yesterday's 97%. This proves the storm is moving east to west, because the denser part of the storm was to the east yesterday. So right now, the sunlight in this area is dropping by 4.5% per sol. If I were to stay here another 16 sols, it would get dark enough to kill me. Just as well I'm not going to stay here.
Log entry. Sol 478. Everything went as planned today. No hiccups. I can't tell if I'm driving deeper into the storm or out of it. It's hard to tell if the ambient light is less or more than it was yesterday. The human brain works hard to abstract that out. I left a power logger behind when I started out. Then, after 40 kilometers travel due south, I had a quick EVA to set up another. Now I've gone the full 80 kilometers, set up my solar cells for charging, and I'm logging the wattage. Tomorrow I'll have to reverse course and pick up the power loggers. It may be dangerous. I'll be driving right back into a known storm area, but the risk is worth the gain. Also, have I mentioned I'm sick of potatoes? Because by God, I am sick of potatoes. If I ever return to Earth, I'm going to buy a nice little home in Western Australia, because Western Australia is on the opposite side of Earth from Idaho. I bring it up because I dined on a meal pack today. I had saved 5 packs for special occasions. I ate the first of them 29 sols ago when I left for Schiaparelli, but I totally forgot to eat the second when I reached the halfway point a few sols ago. So, I'm enjoying my belated halfway feast. It's probably more accurate to eat it today anyway. Who knows how long it'll take me to go around this storm. And if I end up stuck in the storm and doomed to die, I'm totally eating the other earmarked meals. Log entry. Sol 479. Have you ever taken the wrong freeway entrance? You just need to drive to the next exit to turn around, but you hate every inch of travel because you're going away from your goal. I felt like that all day. I'm now back where I started yesterday morning. Yuck. Along the way, I picked up the power logger I'd left behind at the halfway point. Just now, I brought in the one I'd left here yesterday. Both loggers worked the way I'd hoped. I downloaded each of their video recordings to a laptop and advanced them to noon. Finally, I had solar efficiency readings from 3 locations along an 80-kilometer line, all from the same time of day. As of noon yesterday, the northernmost logger showed 12.3% efficiency loss, the middle one had a 9.5% loss, and the rover recorded a 6.4% loss at its southernmost location. It paints a pretty clear picture. The storm's north of me, and I already worked out it's traveling west, so I should be able to avoid it by heading south a ways, letting it pass me to the north, then heading east again. Finally, some good news. Southeast is what I wanted. I won't lose much time. Sigh. I have to drive the same goddamned path a third time tomorrow. Log entry. Sol 480. I think I'm getting ahead of the storm. Having traveled along Mars Highway 1 all day, I'm back at my campsite from yesterday. Tomorrow, I'll finally make real headway again. I was done driving and had the camp set up by noon. The efficiency loss here is 15.6%. Compared to the 17% loss at yesterday's camp, this means I can outrun the storm as long as I keep heading south. Hopefully. The storm is probably circular. They usually are. But I could just be driving into an alcove. If that's the case, I'm just fucking dead, okay? There's only so much I can do. I'll know soon enough. If the storm is circular, I should get better and better efficiency every day until I'm back to 100%. Once I reach 100%, that means I'm completely south of the storm and I can start going east again. We'll see. If there were no storm, I'd be going directly southeast toward my goal. As it is, going only south, I'm not nearly as fast. I'm traveling 90 kilometers per day as usual, but I only get 37 kilometers closer to Schiaparelli because Pythagoras is a dick. I don't know when I'll finally clear the storm and be able to beeline to Schiaparelli again, but one thing's for sure. My plan to arrive on Sol 494 is boned. Sol 549. That's when they come for me. If I miss it, I'll spend the rest of my very short life here. And I still have the MAV to modify before then, too. Sheesh. Log entry. Sol 482. Air day. A time for relaxation and speculation. For relaxation, I read 80 pages of Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun, courtesy of Johansson's digital book collection. I think Linda Marshall is the murderer. As for speculation, I speculated on when the hell I'll get past this storm.
I'm still going due south every day, and still dealing with efficiency loss, though I'm keeping ahead of it. Every day of this crap, I'm only getting 37 kilometers closer to the MAV instead of 90, pissing me off. I considered skipping.